I call this meeting of the House Finance Committee to order. Let the record reflect that it is 1:34 p.m. on Thursday, February 26, 2026. Present today, we have Representative Allard, Representative Stapp, Representative Moore, Co-Chair Josephson, Representative Jimmy, Representative Galvin, Representative Tomaszewski, Representative Hannon, and myself, Co-Chair Strage. Before we start today, please remember to mute your cell phones if you haven't done so already. We have two items on our agenda, first being House Bill 21, the voter pre-registration for minors by Representative Story, and then a presentation by the Department of Commerce, Community, and Economic Development. We heard House Bill 21 last session, so we will hear a brief recap from the representative and her staff, review the updated fiscal notes, and then place the bill aside. And we've been joined by Representative Bynum. With that, I'd like to go ahead and invite Representative Story and her staff, Kaylee Holm, to please come to the table, place yourselves on the record, and begin with your recap when you're ready.
Good afternoon, Chair Schrage and the rest of the committee. It's good to be here this afternoon. I am, for the record, I'm Andy Story, representing the Juneau Northern Valley, Haines, Skagway, Kluckwan, and Gustavus.
And for the record, Kaylee Holm, aide to Representative Andy Story.
Very good.
Well, thank you. I feel that I'll just get into talking about the bill here, and I feel one of the most important jobs we have as legislators is to protect and strengthen our democracy. Democracy does not function without engaged citizens and education. Civics education is really important. I think our form of representative democracy is something I'm so proud of, our right to vote, how we can change our policies based on the person we represent to send to our institutions to advocate for us. And so it's so important that we're engaged. Experts have concluded that the decline in civic engagement, including the drop in voting rates among young voters since way back in 1972, may be a direct result of the decreased emphasis placed on civics during youth. In the last general election, voter turnout among 18 to 19-year-olds in Alaska was 52.62%, while turnout among 65 to 75-year-olds was over 71%, according to the Division of Elections. That gap tells us something important. A significant portion of eligible young Alaskans are not participating in choosing their representatives or shaping public policy, while older generations are participating at much higher rates. That is one of the reasons why I'm proud to sponsor House Bill 21. This legislation addresses civics education, voter apathy, and civic decline. It strengthens our democracy by engaging the next generation of Alaskans to become informed, engaged, and active citizens by allowing 16-year-olds to pre-register to vote. Research shows that the earlier someone begins engaging in civics and voting, the more likely they are to become a consistent, lifelong voter. Voting is habit-forming. When someone participates in their first eligible election, they are significantly more likely to continue voting throughout their life. If we want higher participation in the future, we must begin building that habit early before disengagement sets in. This approach has been active in over 20 other states, and it's proven effective in civic engagement. It has a trickle-down effect. It finds that families, they engage when their child comes home and says, hey, we're talking in my government class about voting, and I can pre-register to vote. Can't vote. Many teachers report that they do want to start voting. Why can't I vote at 16? But it just makes families talk about it more, and they think they're more apt to get to the polls. And, of course, just so important to, as we all know, we want civics engagement. This is hands-on civics engagement. And we had, in our prior testimony, we've had a couple of teachers of the year, social studies teachers of the year, testify on the record how they do talk about registering to voting, because current law is 3 months before you turn 18, you can register to vote. This would expand it to 16. I think timing matters. When you are 3 months before you're going to turn 18, you are thinking about what we're going to do after graduating. There are a lot of rite of passages that happen in your senior year, and I think it can make it so they're moving, they might be starting jobs, leaving for whatever their post-secondary is. And I think if we wait, we risk the opportunity to engage them while they're still connected to the support structures of their families, communities, and schools. And I think it's important to note that school boards have policies. It's very important that staff, just like our legislative legal staff, is nonpartisan. In fact, social studies teachers that I know, they pride themselves on their students not knowing what political persuasion they are at. They really see it as a point of pride to be presenting just how facts and how our government works. When people go to the DMV, and there is a federal law that they need to have the opportunity to sign up to vote. And so a lot of rite of passage when kids are 16, they could, if they chose, they could register to vote at that time. This bill strengthens our democracy by preparing the next generation to participate fully and responsibly. I think that this bill is really important for making sure we take pride in our representative democracy and encourage voting. Thank you. I'm happy to answer any questions.
Wonderful. Representative Galvin.
Thank you. Through the chair, Representative Story, thank you. First and foremost, the premise of this, which is to encourage more participation in democracy, is so greatly admired. I'm very grateful that you've put this forward. I see, from my count, it looks like maybe 13 or 14 states have something similar, wherein 16 years, and I know some have it at 15, but I'm seeing 16 years at that age, they can pre-register. And I guess my question is, have you heard of how it's gone? Has there been concerns about fraud? Have you had any word back from the current status of the other states that have already done this?
Representative Story.
Thank you. Through the chair, I have not seen any of those things happening, and I have pretty much just done online searches about that to see what is in the headlines. You know, the state added this. Has there been any repercussions of that? And most of the articles are just about how the positive things that it has done in their state.
Thank you.
Very good. Representative Bynum.
Thank you. Co-Chair Shragi and through the chair to Representative Story, thank you very much for being here and presenting this bill. I appreciate the passion that you have for this. You'd come to my office a little bit earlier today, and I was telling you a little bit about a good friend of mine who's now passed away. But she was a tremendous advocate for wanting to teach our students in government, and that was Susan Stone. And so when you brought this forward and brought it to me, it really reminded me of her about wanting to teach our kids. And so with that being said, her being such an advocate for student learning, how do you feel that this bill with having students register to vote at 16 will encourage and or promote the actual educational process in the classroom?
Thank you. Through the chair, to Representative Bynum and the committee, I think the public testimony that we've had in a couple of our last committee meeting with Les Wheeler, if I'm remembering the correct committee, and then we had Amy Galanos as Teacher of the Year up in Fairbanks, they right now They talk about registering to vote and talk about, of course, democracy and the importance of voting. But they have testified and felt that it's much better if you can do a hands-on activity with your student, that you can fill out the form there. You can talk about the form. They don't have to fill it out there, go home, talk about your families, however they handle it. But learning in real time. And she said you'd be surprised at the questions they had about the form. And there is a form in your packet about registering to vote, and it's very self-explanatory. But she said kids do have questions about it. But again, they said it's just a great hands-on activity to do. And what I see this doing, we're talking about the teachers of the years here, and I think it's just really helpful that I see this happening and more educational opportunities across the state.
Representative Stapp.
Yeah, thank you, Co-Chair Shragi, through the chair to Representative Story. Thank you for being here. Just a couple of questions I have on the bill. So when I read it and I read the data that you provided, it feels to me that you are proposing a solution that is looking for a problem. And when I see your Fowler study from 2017 that you cite, basically says there is no marginal change in voter turnout by pre-registering people at 16. Alaska already has a pretty robust system of registration, mainly through the permanent fund dividend application. And really the big concern I have in the bill is it requires the Division of Motor Vehicles IT staff to have another person when they're already 2 years behind on critical IT projects. So I'm just wary of asking them to do something else when they are currently not able to do the things we're asking them. So I'm curious if you have any thoughts on that, through the chair.
Representative Story.
Yes, thank you, through the chair, to the committee, to Rep. Stapp. I purposely made that. There's not a lot of studies right now about pre-registering to vote, and so I felt that I should put in what I did find, and they marginal. But again, there is anecdotal evidence, what people are reporting, and they do. Well, again, I cited some of the statistics of not a lot of youth voting, but they feel it has made a difference. As far as the fiscal note, I'm hoping someone is online to talk about the fiscal note.
And Representative Story will be going over fiscal notes as soon as we wrap up with Representative Stapp's questions on the bill. Do you have additional questions, Representative Stapp?
No, that's primarily it.
Okay. Representative Bynum, before we get into fiscal notes.
Yes, thank you, Co-Chair Shragi, through the chair to Representative Story. So one of the things that I've looked at when I think about this, it's a question in my mind as we talk about, we want to give a 16-year-old this autonomy to pre-register to vote. But yet, when we start thinking about responsibilities of becoming an adult, one of the things that many young people need to do is that we have a requirement for selective service. And that's a registration for selective service, and you're required by law if you're a male of the age of 18 to 26 to register for selective service. And you cannot do it before you're 18 years of age. You have to do it within 30 days of turning 18. So it's just, I mean, that's a real important obligation. And, of course, registering to vote and actually the act of voting is a very serious obligation that requires you to understand the issues at hand and the processes. So I'm just trying to weigh this important obligation of selective service versus the importance of voting and why we would want to give that kind of obligation to a 16-year-old without them fully understanding the process. I mean, most of them wouldn't have even voted in student elections at that point or had extensive education in high school. So just kind of weighing that and just want to know what your thoughts were.
Representative Story.
Sure. Thank you, through the chair, to the committee. My thoughts about that are I think kids are involved. Well, since former school board member, I know a lot of kids are involved in running in middle school for being class president or whatever that it starts early. But I feel like when you're pre-registering to vote, at 16, it gives you much longer time to learn about the importance of it because it's like hitting you. Hey, I can be voting. I can be making a difference in our country, in my region. It gives me a lot of power. One person, one vote, but together we can do a lot. You talk about it more. And I think it's important to note with this bill, you pre-register to vote, but 3 months before you turn 18, notice goes to your household, and it says, "Do you? You know, you have to reconfirm that yes, I still live here. Yes, I still want to vote." And it goes in. So then, at that point, 3 months before you're 18, you are confirming that. This is just like we are laying the land for our next generation of being active civically, and we're getting them to talk about it. But then, they do have to confirm. And I think when you're 16, many of our 16-year-olds, they're working. They are going to drive a car. Those are very much adult responsibilities. So I think pre-registering to vote, I think it's good that they're very capable of, yes, I'm starting to learn. And I don't think you're saying 16-year-olds aren't capable about registering to vote, but I take your point about 18 vote. I mean, military service is very important.
Yeah, follow-up, Representative Bynum.
Thank you, Co-Chair Shragi. Through the chair to Representative Story. You just mentioned something, I got to go back and look at the bill again, but yeah, I know you'll know right away. Does this require parental approval to pre-register to vote? Because I know many of the things you mentioned sometimes require parents to get involved and give approval for their child to get maybe driver's license or things like that. So I'm just wondering if this requires a parent to be notified and approve the pre-registration.
Representative Story.
Through the chair, to Rep. Bynum, no, it does not require parental permission.
Thank you.
Representative Allard.
Thank you. Lost my train of thought there for a second. Okay, so there's a couple of points through the chair I'd like to make, and then maybe Representative Story, you could answer a few of them. At 16 years old, I don't think anybody should be open to political propaganda. I don't care who they are. And that's what's going to happen with this. I don't believe that the voter rolls are going to protect minors because all their information is going to be basically out there based on them registering to vote. Now hearing that there's no parental guidance over it, they don't own their own home. So parents are going to be receiving political propaganda to the child's home, and they are a child. The other thing is the government is teaching, taking the opportunity to teach government to children that are still minors, in which the parents should be able to do that. And is this an opt-in or an opt-out?
Representative Story, a couple
questions.
I know
that was a lot. I'm sorry, Representative Story.
Thank you, Rep. Allard, through the chair. I hear your passion for protecting our children, and I share it. And we do have Carol Beecher on the phone from the Divisions of Elections, and this is all confidential information.
Nothing's confidential. Sorry to interrupt you, Rep. Story, but we had, I think it was 130,000 people in the state of Alaska that all their information with the voter rolls was breached.
Thank you.
Representative Story.
Yeah, through the chair. What I'm saying is the Divisions of Elections is creating, and again, Carol Beecher is on the phone. She can explain how she would envision this happening, that all their information goes into a file, and it is not released to, like, voter rolls and things like that because these students are under, or these children are under 18.
Can I ask Carol Beecher a couple questions then, Mr. Chair?
Yes, Representative Allard.
Okay.
Director Beecher, can you hear us? I see you online.
Good afternoon. This is, for the record, Carol Beecher, Director of the Division of Elections.
Thank you, Director. Can you please respond to did you hear Representative Allard's question about confidentiality of minors pre-registering to vote? And can you address it?
The idea would be that these individuals who are pre-registering, that would be a separate list that is completely separate from the list that would be provided to the public. It's completely confidential and would not be provided.
Follow-up question, Representative Allard.
Okay. So if we're pre-registering them to vote, How is this bill, like, I'm kind of confused. If their information isn't out there, nothing's, and if you can guarantee me 100% their information would never be leaked, that would be great. Number one question, guaranteed 100% won't be leaked. The other question would be, if their information is being hidden, then what is the point to pre-registering them? Because are they going to be possibly receive propaganda in the mail? Why would we pre-register if it doesn't do anything?
Director Beecher.
Through the chair, Carol Beecher. I believe, Representative Allard, that is a question more for the sponsor. In regards to your question about confidentiality or records 100%, being, I don't think that anyone could ever guarantee that, given the world of IT that we live in. And I would also note that on the, well, I'll stop there. Thank you.
I've got Representative Tomaszewski in the queue, but Representative Stamp, did you have a question specifically on this for Director Beecher? Representative Stamp.
Thank you, Co-Chair. Just to the Director Beecher. So just continuing on Rep. Allard's line of thought here, cyber attack that basically, you know, took all the voter roll information, are you going to store the miners? If you were to do this, would you store the miners' information electronically? Through the chair.
Director Beecher?
Through the chair, Carol Beecher, if Representative Staff, if I understood your question correctly, you're asking if the information would be stored electronically?
That's correct, through the chair.
Yes, it would be stored in the voter registration system.
Follow up, Mr. Co-Chair.
Follow up.
Yeah, thank you, Co-Chair, through the chair to Ms. Beecher. So even though it'll be a separate list and it won't be releasable to the public, in the event that you had another cybersecurity breach, this data would be able to be breached in the same way the initial voter data was. Is that correct, through the chair?
Through the chair, Representative Staff, the extrusion that occurred was not in our voter registration system. It was the absentee ballot, application for the absentee ballots, which is different. So we do not believe that this would be able to be breached. We're behind the state security walls, since that time, a different system and are much more a robust security platform.
Follow up. Yeah, thank you, Co-Chair, through the chair, Tim Breacher. That kind of sounds worse. The absentee information sounds worse than just the voter registration information. So I'm glad you can give me some sort of guarantees that if we were going to have miners' data being stored electronically, that it would at least be more secure than voter absentee data. So I guess thanks. Yield.
Okay, very good. On this specifically, Co-Chair Josephson?
For the sponsor on the bill.
Okay, I'm going to go to Representative Tomaszewski next, if I may. Representative Tomaszewski.
Thank you, Co-Chair Shargi, through the chair. So I have the State of Alaska voter registration application that you provided in the packet.
Yeah.
Thank you.
Mm-hmm.
In the first section, it says, you must complete this section for registration. I am at least 18-year-old or will be within 90 days of completing this application. Mm-hmm. So I'm curious if it'll be the same for the 16-year-old. Will there be a 90-day before 16 for the 16-year-olds? Will there be a little grace period there? Because it looks like, I mean, you're moving it to 16. Can you comment on that a little bit?
Representative Story.
Thank you, through the chair, Rep. Tomaszewski. This is the current form that would have to be changed, that section there. The 18, that form, they would have to adapt it if this bill, and I think that had something to do with the fiscal note that we have with this bill.
Representative
Tomaszewski. And then if I'm following your line of questioning, why we would be pre-registering them at 16, why I would like to join the other states doing this is because, again, I'm trying to promote democracy, representative democracy, and getting kids fired about civic engagement, hands-on. And so, but they're not going to be able to vote till they're 18. And so 3 months before they turn 18, just like the current practice is, the division has to send the card to the information that they have back to that home, because people move. Those 16-year-olds might not be there, but they might not be in state. They might be in a bit of different district within inside the state of Alaska. So they have to at that time say, yes, I still want to vote. You know, I do want to vote. And then it goes back to the division, and the division then confirms that and sends them their card in the mail, so they're ready to go.
Representative Tomaszewski.
Yeah.
Yeah, I was just asking about the 90 days before. So is it going to be it going to read 16 years old or will be 90 in 90 days from the time completing this form?
Representative Story.
Through the chair, no, I had not thought about doing that.
So that's not what it's going to be. It's just going to be 16 years old.
Representative Story.
Yes, through the chair. Yes.
Okay, thank you.
Okay, very good. Representative Josephson.
Yes, thank you, Mr. Chairman. Actually, a question for, if I might, for Ms. Beecher, if she's still with us.
I believe she is. Representative Josephson.
Ms. Beecher, I noticed that in subsection B of the bill, of section 1 of the bill, it focuses on 15-07-060A, and I'm struck by the fact that there's an attestation. So this is getting 16 and 17-year-olds in the habit of attesting, which is a kind of solemn oath, that they are who they purport to be, that they have presented identification showing who they claim to be, that they have not previously been registered to vote elsewhere, which would be hard to do because they're 16 or 17, that they'll be 18 within 90 days, well, currently after the date of registration, that changes with the bill, that they, importantly, a declaration that they are a citizen of the United States, et cetera. It strikes me that this might arguably be helpful in starting to attune people to the necessity of, swearing an attestation, getting facts right, telling the truth, and being able to identify that they're an eligible voter. Is that one reading of this?
Director Beecher?
Through the chair, Carol Beecher, Representative Chair Josephson. Yes, I would read that statute as making sure that individuals understand before they or when they provide that information that they need to it needs to be accurate and true.
Okay, follow up. So in a sense, it's the beginning of the process of telling a teenager, this is serious stuff, and you're reporting to public officials under law that you wish to be eligible someday, and you're providing basic facts about who you are, that you're a citizen of the country, and you will be eligible in 2 years or less. I mean, that this bill gets a teenager sort of focused on those important principles. Is that a fair statement?
Director Beecher?
Through the chair, Chair Josephson, I think that is a question more for the sponsor of the bill. Currently, the law requires that of someone who's going to be 18 at election or an 18-year-old, but as regards the mindset of a 16-year-old, I can't speak to that.
Okay. But I took note of your previous answer. Thank you, Director Beecher.
Very good. I've got Representatives Moore and Allard in the queue, and then I think we're going to hold questions so that we can take up fiscal notes before getting back into some dialogue. All right. Representative Moore.
Thank you, Chair. I think my first question is for Director Beecher, and I'm curious about the database for storing the 16-year-olds' information. Is there an option to do an offline database, keep it on ice while we're waiting to move and send out information for them right before they turn 18? Or is that an option?
Director Beecher?
Through the chair, Representative Moore, I would say that anything's possible with enough time and money, but we would certainly look at all the different options to make sure that the information is isolated from any list that could be provided or accessed until the notifications went out to the individuals.
Okay, thank you.
Follow-up, Representative
yes,
Moore?
Thank you so much. This is for the maker of the bill. Where am I at? I was going to ask about when you were analyzing how this is done in different states. It's obviously done in several other states and successfully. So did they require a second position or another position to be hired in another department, in their DMV departments, to carry the weight of what we're trying to accomplish here?
Representative Story.
Through the chair, thank you. Rep. Allard for that. I do not know that answer, but that is a good question
okay.
for me to follow
yeah.
up on. Thank
yeah,
you.
Yeah, I'd love a follow-up on that. Thank you.
Okay, very good. And now the actual Representative Allard.
Oh, I'm sorry,
that's
Rep.
Quite
Allard.
All right.
Okay.
Sorry.
She's gorgeous. I'm good with it.
Representative Allard.
I know. So I wanted to ask you a couple of questions. Maybe it goes to Director Beecher. Director Beecher, are we going to update the registration form, because it says that they need to furnish their full, middle, and last name, Social Security number, full or the last four, driver's license or ID, date of birth, and political affiliation. This is all required to pre-register to vote without parental approval. And then I'll go on to a couple more if the chair will let me.
Director Beecher?
Through the chair, Representative Allard, could you repeat your question?
Representative Allard.
Thank you. On the State of Alaska voter registration application, it requires their full name, middle name, last name, their identifiers, which would be either a full Social Security number or the last four of the Social Security number, driver's license or state ID, and then their date of birth and political affiliation. And I don't see anywhere on there. Yeah, right. So can you help me with that?
Director Beecher?
Through the chair, we would have to have a form that we provide that is specific to this pre-registration for the 16-year-olds. But the information required on this, for the most part, aside from the I am at least 18-year-olds or will be within 90 days, would be required for pre-registration of 16-year-olds.
Okay, I'm really confused now because I'm trying to figure out if we're going to pre-register 16-year-olds, what information are they going to gather? And I'm not hearing that. Did she answer that?
Director Beecher, are you able to address Representative Allard's question?
Through the chair, Representative Allard, the form that you see that are you referring to of our current state registration form for voters,
yes,
all
ma'am.
Of the information that's required, the citizen, the first last name, residence address, mailing address, identifier of whichever identifier, date of birth, the sex. They're not required to provide political affiliation, and obviously they wouldn't be registered in another state. All of those things would be required for pre-registration.
Oh, that's not good.
The one thing that would be quite different would be that they are not 18 years of age, but they would be at least 16 years old.
Okay, and then I just have one last question.
Follow-up, Representative Allard.
Thank you. Do you know if 16-year-olds, I know in the state of Alaska there are certain contracts that 16-year-olds can't sign. Are we aware that, are we going to change the law saying 16-year-olds can sign this as a contract and they'll be held liable without a parent's consent in order to do this?
Director Beecher, are you aware of legal concerns with a 16-year-old signing such a document?
Through the chair, Representative Allard, that's something that I would point to the sponsor to respond to.
Okay. May I rephrase that just a little bit?
Yes, Representative Allard.
Okay, thank you, Chair. So on here it says I certify under penalty and perjury. I don't know that a 16-year-old would actually understand what it would mean to go under penalty or perjury. Could you explain how you would handle that?
Representative Story?
Yes, through the chair. And I'm going to go back to my conversation earlier with teachers, and maybe I made light of it with thinking the form is elementary in a way, how to fill it out. But I think this is what they're talking about, where it brings up a lot of discussions with kids because they do have questions about voter affiliation, things like that. What does that mean? And the whole point of one of the points of doing this is something that you come home, you discuss that with your families. You know, what, do we have a voter affiliation? I mean, some families are more active about democracy and participation than others, and this is an educational tool in a way.
Just one last comment, please.
Yeah, one last comment, and then we'll go to the fiscal notes.
Okay. So what I see happening here is moving up the registration, the age, a bridge to opening up the ability for these 16-year-olds to eventually be able to vote. My also concern is that it sounds like eventually this will like be in a classroom that we can say, hey, you're 16. You can go ahead and fill this form out, and then you could pre-register to vote, and that are government employees pushing politics on minors without the parents' consent. That is political propaganda. Okay, thank you.
Representative Story, do you want to address those concerns?
Yeah, just through the chair. And I try and that would be something that would be against school policy to do that. Like I said at the beginning, you have school policies and you're supposed to be nonpartisan and you're not supposed to preach to individuals about politics. And I know you're saying, well, maybe some people would do that. But that is not good professional ethics to do that.
Very good. Thank you very much for the dialogue. I think we're now going to go to fiscal notes. We have two fiscal notes for this bill. The first fiscal note is going to be from the Office of the Governor, Division of Elections. Director Beecher, can you please walk us through your fiscal note and verify the control code on your end?
Thank you. For the record, this is Carol Beecher, Division of Elections. The fiscal note control code is lowercase XXU, capital V, capital F. This fiscal note is an updated fiscal note to reflect the 2025 population totals estimates for 16-year-olds, as well as a little bit of an increase for the 78 cents on postage that is up from the previous 73 cents.
Director Beecher, can you tell me the magnitude of the change overall?
It would result in an estimated annual cost of $16,410.
And that's updated from what number previously?
I'm sorry. I don't have my previous fiscal note. I apologize.
That's all right. We can follow up later. Are there questions from the committee on this fiscal note from the Division of Elections? Okay. Representative Allard.
Yeah, thank you. Mrs. Beecher, I'm kind of confused here. Are you saying it's only $16,000 a year to get kids to pre-register to vote their parents' consent?
Director Beecher.
Through the chair, Representative Allard, that is our estimate based on every 16-year-old under the population estimate registering to vote. At 16, we don't anticipate that there will be that many, but if there were, it would be a form that they would send to the division. We don't anticipate it costing more for us to process that form and put it into the appropriate file.
Is she talking about the form that the child would send without their parents' permission to the Division of Elections?
Director Beecher, do you want to clarify that response to Representative Allard?
Through the chair, Representative Allard, I would be speaking to any of the pre-registration forms from 16-year-olds. So whether or not they had permission, we would not know that based on the current process.
Okay. Any other questions on the fiscal note from the Division of Elections? Not seeing any. I'd like to now call up Mr. Brody Anderson to walk the committee through the fiscal note for the Department of Motor Vehicles. Separately, I will note that for any questions there may be, we do have Division Director Kathleen Wallace online for questions. Mr. Anderson, can you please put yourself on the record and walk us through the fiscal note and verify the control code?
Thank you. For the record, Brody Anderson, staff to Representative Foster. Today before the committee is a fiscal note from the Department of Administration. Motor vehicles control code is JCIGO. The fiscal note starting from the top, there is for FY27 expenditures, and then continuing on through the rest of the next 5 years, there will be a personal services of $149,000 per year. So the total fund source for that operating cost of the personal services is $149,000 of DGF, which would actually be the DMV receipt authority. There is an increase in one position that would continue on through. In the explanation on the second page, the increase of cost is for the cost of the fiscal note is for one full-time position to be added to motor vehicles as an analyst for programmer, and it reflects the cost of being at a step C. It's roughly $148,000 starting in FY27. Mr. Chair, Chairman, that is the fiscal note in summary.
Okay, very good. And I see we have a whole queue of representatives asking to get in the line. Can I just verify before we jump into questions that we have Director Wallace online? Director Wallace, can you hear us okay, and are you online?
Yes, I can.
Okay, very good. Thank you. First up in the queue, we have Representative Galvin.
Thank you. This would be a question for Director Wallace. The question is, it seems like what we're asking for is changing a form by maybe a couple of different in a couple spots here. And I understand that your staff apparently is very far behind on things due to high demand for programming efforts within DMV IT. That sounds like a scream for help for DMV in general, but if we're just changing one form, I'm wondering why we need to hire an IT person for the entire year as opposed to maybe a couple of hours of overtime for someone you have on staff already. Both answers, whatever your answer is, it's fine. I just want to try to better understand where we are with this fiscal note.
Director Wallace?
Sure. For the record, this is Kathy Wallace, director of the DMV, through the co-chair to Representative Galvin. It's not simply changing a couple of forms. What would need to be due, we electronically submit to Division of Elections all of the voter registrations we collect. So it's not only changing programming for in-person voter registrations for folks that come into the DMV offices and business partner offices. It's also for through our online gateway for people that register to vote that way. So it's, although changing the forms is part of it, there is a lot more programming and interagency connectivity that has to happen to make this change with this bill.
All right. Follow-up, Representative Galvin.
Follow-up. Thank you. And may I ask, it says due to high, I'm going to find the words here so that I don't misquote. And I know I would like to know what that means. Due to high demand for programming efforts within the DMV IT staff, the division is currently 2 years behind on, quote, critical projects, end quote. So it sounds to me like this position would do quite a few things, and I just want to make sure I'm highlighting that for the committee because, as with so many things, what I'm hearing is that we are not appropriately ensuring that we have some of these critical projects done because, for whatever reason, we don't seem to have staffing available for the good government projects that need to happen. Thank you. That was just a comment. And thank you, Director Wallace.
Representative Hannon.
Thank you, Chair Shragi. I'm going to continue on that line and ask specifically, what are the critical projects that we are 2 years behind on at DMV?
Director Wallace.
Sure. Again, for the record, Director Wallace, Division of Motor Vehicles, through the chair. We have multiple, well, outside of general enhancements to help modernize DMV and make things more efficient for Alaskans, we have federally compliant changes that have to be made. So our IT staff is limited. When it's fully staffed, we have 4 IT folks on the entire DMV IT side of the team. So each time something comes up with a, you know, deadline that you have to meet, for example, we have a few federal deadlines where we have to change the way we process commercial driver's licenses in our system. So we have to pull somebody from a project to put on that project. This is just another example of we have to pull somebody off of what they're doing now to work on this bill. So the ask for additional staff is so that we can continue to catch up on the backup and the backlog of things that our staff are working on and still be able to meet the requirements of getting this, if it were to pass, operational.
Well,
yep, Representative
Thank
Hannon.
You, Chair Shragi. So, Ms. Wallace, are you telling me that we are not in compliance with federal regulations for CDL screening?
Director Wallace.
No. Sorry. Through the chair. No, I'm not saying that. We are. There are some upcoming deadlines in 27 and 28 where we have some programming that we have to complete. So we have our staff working on that. It takes a lot of time. It's working with FMCSA. It's multi-agency programming. So to pull somebody off of dedicating them to that, to put them on this, just slows every process down.
One more follow-up?
Follow-up.
Did DMVA, through the chair, did DMVA submit a request in their budget proposal to OMB to acquire another IT person so that they were not 2 years behind and we could be in compliance with federal regulations and expectations and perhaps not create a scenario where our citizens who are eligible to be registered to receive driver's license and end up in a snafu where they are by mistake as American Samoans charged with voting fraudulently because our systems may have led both your employees and those registering and completing a driver's license to be automatically registered? Is that one of the snafus? But really, did you submit in your budget request so that you could be compliant and not 2 years behind?
Director Wallace.
Through the chair. We did not submit this year for a additional IT position. We did the previous year, and it was denied. So we did not turn around and ask for a position again this year.
Thank you.
Director Wallace, these programmers that are working to get us caught up on this two-year backlog, are they the same programmers that would have been working on the digital driver's license, which was released this last year?
Yes.
Representative Stout?
Yeah, thank you, Co-Chair Shragi. I got two separate ones here. I'm going to beat the dead horse here, but I'll be a little more blunt, I think, through the chair. So, Director Wallace, I see something this looks very simple to me. I see a new position you have going out for in perpetuity, at least 6 years in the fiscal note, probably forever. It can't take 6 years to change your IT. I think what you're asking for is you just want to use this bill as a vehicle to have another IT person to fill your backlog. That's what I think is happening. Do you have an answer for that through the chair?
Director Wallace.
Through the chair. I can see where it could be seen like that.
Any follow-up, Representative Stout?
It's through the chair. It's just totally okay. I mean, I think I'm not going to speak for everyone else at the finance table, but I mean, we like. I think most of us are going to agree. We want to help you guys do the best job you can, and if there's anything we can do to do that, we can look at facilitating that. But I'm going to shift gears here and go to Mr. Anderson. The weird thing on the fiscal note to me, Mr. Anderson, said programmatic receipts. Where does the DMB programmatic receipt fund go currently? Through the chair, is that if this overcapitalizes, does it flow into the general fund?
Mr. Anderson,
through the chair, Representative, that is correct. DMVA receipts are collected through the fees that are acquired through all of the transactions and fees that happen to DMV. At DMV, once they're allocated back into their budget to pay for their budget, any leftover lapsing funds, then usually it can be a little bit of a larger chunk of money than becomes GF at the end of the year.
Follow-up, Mr. Co-Chair. You probably don't know this off the top of your head. I'm going to ask you anyways, Mr. Anderson. Do you know how much we lapse or how much we deposit in the general fund from the programmatic receipts?
Mr. Anderson.
Through the chair, I would I could only answer that anecdotally, so I would, if I could have the indulgence of the committee to get back to you on a hard number after conferring with Legislative Finance Division.
Last follow-up is going to be back to Director Wallace. I could, Chair.
Director Wallace?
Yes.
Oh, excuse me. Representative Stafford, Director Wallace.
Yeah, thank you. Thank you, Coach Shaggy. As the Chair, Director Wallace. Do you currently have any vacancies in your IT folks at DMV?
Director Wallace.
Yes, Director Wallace. Through the chair, yes, we have one vacancy that we have been trying to fill since November. We were checking references, so we are almost to the point of hiring. The struggle is in the IT world, you can make more money in the private sector, so finding qualified applicant to fill these vacancies has been difficult.
I am picking up what you are throwing down, as the kids used to say. Thank you, Director.
And I'm going to go to Mr. Anderson because I believe you may have been handed a lifeline here to Representative Stapp's prior question on the DGF lapse.
Through the chair, thank you, Chairman Shragi. Yes, to answer the Representative Stapp's previous question, I have received a lifeline from Legislative Finance. It is approximately $30 million dollars of UGF.
Okay, very good. Thank you to our good friends over at Legislative Finance for the quick help. Next up, we have Representative Moore.
Thank you, Chair. I think both of my questions were asked, but maybe I'll just try to get some clarification from Mrs. Wallace on the position taking, you know, from the fiscal note here, it seems like we are hiring a position to help with the backlog and to update this programming for pre-registration. Why would we hire this person for 6 years? Why wouldn't this just be until the programming is complete and then the department can take over from there without having to have another position for 6 years? Can you maybe walk me through that a little bit?
Director Wallace.
Sure, through the chair. There is always continued changes, requirements, audits through the Division of Elections and the NVRA, which is the National Voter Registration Act. It is true that the programming for this would not take 6 years. However, there is continued maintenance that this position would then be able to handle and not put back on our already overbooked IT staff.
Okay. Thank you so much. Okay. I appreciate the answer.
Representative Bynum.
Thank you, Co-Chair Shragi. I think some of the questions have already been asked and answered about the fiscal note. I guess now that it's my turn, I'll just give some frustration here. I understand this is a policy bill in front of us. We have a fiscal note in front of us that gives us some kind of an indication on what it may or may not cost. But when I look at this fiscal note, and I apologize in advance to the department, when I look at this fiscal note from DMV about what it would cost to maintain this particular bill, of being $750,000 over the next 5 years, I just have a really hard time believing that. It just is unbelievable to me. And so when I see these notes and they come in front of us, I really want to rely on them that it's going to tell us actually what it's going to cost to implement a bill and then maintain it. But, you know, we already have a voter registration system in place, Co-Chair Shragi, and that system has to be maintained currently. And I agree that there's probably some level of cost to modify the system to add this feature. But $750,000 with an ongoing cost year after year, I just don't believe it. And so I'm not sure how we get this fixed, or if we can, or if we ignore it. So I'm just trying to figure out how we move forward when we look at these and what kind of value they really bring if they're not a true reflection of what it costs to implement a bill and then maintain a bill.
Mr. Anderson, are you possibly able to address the process by which a fiscal note can be corrected?
Through the chair, the committee has a couple options. One is to continue to work with the department to see if they could readdress some of the concerns and if they could find a different source and or changing some of the approach to their fiscal note. There is the possibility of what would be considered the carrot versus the stick. One of the options that House Finance does have is to create its own fiscal note and then submit that fiscal note to move on with a bill that moves out of this committee with an attached House Finance fiscal note that is created internally through the co-chair of the co-chairs along with LFD to create the fiscal note that might be better reflective of the intentions of this committee moving the bill out.
Next up, I've got Co-Chair Josephson.
If I could return briefly to Director Beecher for a question. Director, are you still with us?
Yes. Through the chair of Representative Josephson, yes, I'm online.
Thank you. As I read this bill as carefully as I know how to, its focus, again, is on 1507060A. And the reason I'm asking this question is there was a question raised by Representative Allard where she expressed fear that a teacher could essentially proselytize or otherwise support some form of propaganda to tilt student audiences in one direction or another. And I note that the bill excludes any reference, those sections in A, numbers 1 through 12, to party affiliation. So if a teacher were going to say to a 17-year-old, please be a libertarian, that is the best party, let me tell you why. First of all, as Representative Story said, that could run afoul of guidelines and rules. It could be a demerit. It could be all sorts of things. And by the way, would spread quickly through the hallway that this was an event, so to speak, that this happened. But even if the student digested that information, they couldn't fill out the form and say, make me a libertarian. Is that how you read this?
Director Beecher?
Through the chair, for the record, this is Carol Beecher, Director of Division of Elections. Representative Josephson, yes, they are not mandated to put a political affiliation. If they do not, then they are undeclared for our system purposes. But yes, they do not have to put something in that line.
Follow up. Director, it seems like it's more than that, because A1 through 12 says there's no place on the form for it for a 16 or 17-year-old. In other words, your typical form that Representative Tomaszewski cited is simply not the form that could be used under this bill.
Director Beecher?
Through the chair, Representative Josephson, that is correct. We would have to have a form that was specific to the pre-registration of 16-year-olds that would add language that accommodated for the 16-year-olds.
Okay. The only other comment,
yeah.
Just a quick comment. This isn't a contract. This is an application. Contracts are different. And I would note real quickly, if I might, Co-Chairman, and it's noted right here in subsection 12,
all of the criminal code. We don't have separate juvenile code linked to separate juvenile offenses. So all the offenses, election-related offenses that would apply in 1556 would also apply in these circumstances. They would be juvie crimes, theoretically. And all of the offenses under AS 11 relating to perjury would apply as well. So, yes, we would be telling young people, this is serious stuff. And I would also note real quickly, it requires the applicant's signature. We know how important it is that signatures look identical. Apparently that's important. They would have to state any former name. We know that that's an issue I've read about in the press, that we got to start to track your names because you could be committing fraud. And so this is a means of sort of focusing on these issues that people currently are raising concerns with. Thank you for the liberty, Mr. Co-Chair.
Absolutely, Mr. Co-Chair. With that, Representative Hannon's next.
Thank you, Co-Chair Shragi. And I'm actually sort of returning to fiscal notes, and I'm not sure if you recall what the digital driver's license bill had as a fiscal note for implementation of it. Is DMV still online?
I believe Director Wallace is still online, and I actually don't recall when the bill to enact digital driver's licenses was, or if it even was a bill. Director Wallace, can you give us the origin on the digital driver's licenses?
Through the chair, this is Director Wallace. I do not know off the top of my head what that fiscal note was, but I can get you that information.
Okay. Representative Hannon, follow-up.
Do you know if we've been able to implement digital driver's license, or are they part of our backlog?
Director Wallace.
Through the chair, yes. The digital driver's license is available now. It's implemented and being accepted by TSA in Anchorage and Juneau currently.
Okay. Thank you.
And Representative Allard.
Thank you. So, Director Beecher, I'm still a little bit concerned about the application. I do hear that you said that there would be a couple of things removed from the application. For instance, I think it was the political affiliation, if I'm correct, or they don't have to answer it. I can't recall for this application. But on the application, are we going to remove that they're certified under penalty of perjury, that this could be a felony for a minor without a parent's consent to sign? Because I guess it says the application, you can be convicted of a misdemeanor under AS 15.56050.
Director Beecher.
Through the chair, Representative Allard, Cal Beecher for the record, Division of Elections. In reading the bill in Section C, the way that the process is lined out in the bill is that the pre-registration by the 16-year-old, we would send them a notice 90 days prior to, or 45 days, what is it, 90 days prior to the election date, or prior to when they turn 18. And when we receive that back with the current or updated residence address, they would then be registered. And so they have to, the information that they provide would have to be similar in most ways to what we currently have. And so political affiliation is something that is on our form. It would be on the form. They do not have to provide it. It is not a mandated component, but it would remain on the form as well as the perjury component.
Okay. So,
I
just need a little clarification. Ms. Beecher, I know that the political affiliation, you say they can just leave it blank. What about the voter certificate, the read and sign portion for their signature? Can they just leave that blank, and do they have to have ID to register?
Director Beecher?
Pre-register. Pre-register.
Representative Allard, for the pre-registration, it would be a form that had the required information under 15-07-060, and they would have to have all of that information. The difference would be that it would be noted that they are 16 years old, and so it would go into a different
place within our system until we were triggered by the birth date to send them the notice to confirm their residence address is still the same. And then they, if it is, they respond to that, then they would be registered to vote.
Okay. Can I just ask one last question of clarification to the sponsor? In order to pre-register, does a child just pick up the phone and say, hey, I want to pre-register to vote? How are we going to tell the child, hey, you could come down and pre-register to vote? You don't need your parents' consent, but come down here and register to vote. How are we advertising to the children if we don't have their information?
Representative Story.
Thank you for the question, through the chair. I think that how that would happen is sort of how it happens now. Right now when you register to vote, you learn about it through, you can sign up at the library. Individuals will be told, hey, we have this new law in Alaska. If you want to sign up to pre-register, you can vote. I see, like I said before, teachers have thought it'd be great in government social studies to be able, they bring it out anyway to talk about you're going to register to vote. And like, they talk about it in government classes. It's very common. And, you know, our voting system here, our representative democracy, and they, as our teachers of the year testified, they look at the form, they talk about it, kids go home, it brings up questions with their parents, very common thing. But I don't have any funds to start a promotion. I'm hoping we will be talking about it more, certainly because that's the whole intent of this, is to be encouraging civics education and engagement.
Can I just ask one last question for clarification, please?
Representative Allard.
I know that we're not supposed to push any particular thing as far as government employees who teach our children. My question about it is, are they, because when an 18-year-old gets ready to vote, is this document to pre-register going to be in the classroom for the children to do it without the teacher, you know, influencing with political party without the parents' consent?
Through the chair to Rep. Allard, I don't know the current system. I don't know what they would set up. I know, senior week, Juneau League of Women Voters is oftentimes at the high schools to sign kids up to vote if they want to. But I certainly do not have anything set sort of in my head about how it would happen. But I really feel that I'm hoping it happens through our education systems. I hope it happens right now that you're at the library. I'm hoping people would learn more about, yes, you can pre-register when you're 16 to vote. And let's talk about that more. What does that mean? What does it mean to our form of democracy and how we vote is very different from other countries. I see it as an opportunity that we have in this state, like other states have taken the opportunity to, is to help kids realize the importance of voting. And I know you believe in that very strongly, the importance of voting. So I am not sure how different people would react to promoting this and putting it out there. But I believe that from just talking to people, they'd be excited about it. And I believe it does good things.
Okay.
And we are getting close to needing to switch over to our second item of business today. But I know that there's two representatives that still want to get some questions in. Maybe we can keep them short if possible. Representative Bynum, I've got you next.
Thank you, Co-Chair Shragi, through the chair to Representative Story. Really appreciate the passion on this and the idea about trying to get engagement. We'll have follow-up questions. I really want to kind of get into that. We don't need to do it today. But I do have a question about specifically how – have we looked at how this program, when we administer it, how it might impact rural communities? Because, I mean, if you're in a big city, you're in Anchorage, Fairbanks, there's – you know, you have – direct information being passed back and forth relatively quickly. A lot of times that same level of service is not there for rural communities. So I was wanting to get a better understanding of, have you looked at how this may be implemented and be impacted by trying to implement this program in the rural communities?
Representative Story.
Thank you, through the chair, for that question. I have particularly thought about what I like so much about the 16-year-old pre-registering to vote, and remember, it's totally voluntary, but it gives more time, and when you register, particularly in rural Alaska, I think it would be an excellent vehicle to make sure people are ready to go when they turn 18, because it will be done. They will have been pre-registered when they're 16, 17, and the card is going to come to them 3 months before they turn 18. That's the process now, currently. And so I think there's just more time allowed, and when more time is available, I think that it helps with some efficiencies.
And one follow-up?
Very brief.
So thank you, Chair, Co-Chair Shragi, through the chair to Representative Story. So when these cards are being sent out, they're not being sent out with return postage, are they?
Representative Story?
Through the chair, I would like to go to Director Beecher about that. I know one of the fiscal notes is for postage for when it goes to them. I'm not sure if there's postage paid back.
Director Beecher, can you address the postage?
Through the chair, for the record, Carol Beecher, Director of Division of Elections. In Section C, it would require that the notice includes a postage prepaid and pre-addressed return card.
Okay. Representative Galvin?
Thank you. Through the chair, Representative Story, I again want to reiterate that I appreciate this bill. As someone who has been a registrar, I think once a registrar, always a registrar, it's one of those things where I've experienced running into very excited graduates. So a lot of, Rotarians do this, League of Women Voters do this, many different groups go to graduations, celebrate this passage of time, and encourage folks in a very nonpartisan way, let's celebrate democracy, sign up. And there are many graduates who are 17 and a half, even 16. So I can imagine this being, and I've had to turn them away. Sorry, unless you're turning 18 in, I think it's 90 days, we can't have you fill it out. So that alone, to me, is helpful. I think nobody should ever be that, you know, that excitement of having that opportunity to practice democracy is wonderful. And I can see why 21 other states are doing this. And I just wanted to close with that I want to put it back on the table that I've had firsthand experience of turning folks away. And I think in rural Alaska, they might have to print a form out or go online to find the form. But I don't see, just like anywhere else, if you're able to do it at 16, you're able to do it at 16. So I'm actually thinking this might be helpful statewide. So thank you.
Okay, and the very last question, we'll go to Representative Hannon.
Well, thank you. I was actually going to just share that for 20 years in my government classroom, I did voter registration with my seniors, and many of them are not yet 18, but they are within 90 days of it. So it is already legal to register to vote prior to being 18 without parental consent. I also, through those 20 years of being a voter registrar, and yes, once you're a voter registrar, so you always are, I did it 20 years with high school students. There are many people who are confused. Representative Josephson pointed out one of the things on the form of getting young people clear about affidavits, and the voter registration form says you can give us your full Social Security number, and I always said to students, this is one of those places to learn you should never give your Social Security number out unless it is the required by law. If the bank, the IRS, or your job, those are places where you're required to give it. Many colleges will ask you for it, but you're not required to give them your full Social Security number. Do not give it to them. So learn that just because someone has asked for this data, you should not feel compelled to do it if you have another option for an identifier. And to those students who were 16 and sitting in a class because they were young or precocious or for whatever reason they are a 16-year-old in a government class, what I think the essence of this bill for me is to remind them, you're not eligible to vote this cycle, but you will be by the next election. And for most people to engage in voting and participation, it takes you got to be motivated to do it. And so to plant the seed that you're not an eligible voter today, you're feeling very motivated and you're feeling left out because your classmates are eligible to vote and you're not, but you will be by the next election. And remember that. I also did in those same, especially with spring semester when virtually all the seniors are 18 or within 90 days, we did. Here's your day for selective service. Gentlemen, you're required to. None of the ladies in the room are. Have you looked at a medical power of attorney? Because now that you're 18, you probably need to have one. And have you done a will and a will registration? And that's always the day where they would all say, well, you're really bumming us out, Hannon, because we thought turning 18 was all... all these great privileges, and I'd say, and all these obligations that you have to one another and legal obligations, you should make sure that you have discussed with your parents and know how you would feel. But inspiring 16-year-olds to start paying attention, sometimes it requires more than once to remind them to pay attention if you've ever encountered 16-year-olds. So thank you, Madam, or thank you, Mr. Chairman, and thank you for sponsoring this bill.
Question or a comment, Representative Stout?
I just wanted to say I would have loved to have Representative Hannon as a teacher.
Very good. All right. At this point, we are going to set this bill aside, take a very quick break just to hand the gavel over and prepare for our next presentation. We're at ease.
We're back on record at 2:52 p.m. in the Al Adams Room, February 26, 2026. Next, we will hear from the Department of Commerce, Community and Economic Development. With us today from the department is Julie Sandy, Commissioner, and Hannah Lager, Director for the Division of Administrative Services. Commissioner Sandy and ASD Lager have already come forward. Some housekeeping. I have to leave just after 3:15, and I will turn the gavel back to Co-Chair Shragi at that time. My recommendation is that the two of you do a fairly light touch in the obvious places, and then when you get to the budget asks and the 2026 experience, I'd recommend you slowing down if you wish to. So with that, if you put your names on the record and begin your presentation.
Thank you very much, Chair Josephson. For the record, my name is Julie Sandy, and I'm the Commissioner of Commerce, Community, and Economic Development. It's a pleasure to be here today. I'd also just like to recognize, obviously, we have in the room Hannah Lager, our Administrative Services Director, and we have Lizzie Kuex, our Legislative Liaison, and we have Sylvan Robb, who's the Director of our CBPL, our Corporations and Businesses and Professional Licensing. We appreciate their time in being here today and, of course, all the work that they do. Just very briefly, I just wanted to provide, for those of you who haven't seen it before, a very brief slide on our mission and organization and the way that we are organized. We have our executive team, our 8 corporate agencies, and then our 7 core divisions. And of course, our mission is to promote a healthy economy, strong communities, and to protect the consumers in Alaska. This next one is just a slide showing how we're organized. We have our core divisions, and then in blue, those are the 8 corporate agencies. We have our administrative services, our broadband office, banking and securities, community and regional affairs, corporations, businesses, professional licensing, investments, and insurance. And then our 8 corporate agencies, of course, are Alaska Seafood Marketing Institute, Alcohol and Marijuana Control Office, Alaska Oil and Gas Conservation Commission, the Regulatory Commission of Alaska, the Alaska Energy Authority, Alaska Industrial Development Export Authority, the Alaska Gas Line Development Corporation, and the Alaska Railroad Corporation. We include them, though it's important to note that they are not a part of the Executive Budget Act, and so we do not have a presentation on their budget for the good of the order.
Okay. We'll go to slide 4.
Thank you. This is Hannah Lager. For the record, the department's fiscal year 2027 budget request totals $242.8 million, which is shown on the slide in just a couple of different ways. Of our total budget, just that small blue stripe at the bottom, $15.9 million, is unrestricted general funds. In the 2027 budget, our request is down $4.6 million overall and down $5.8 million in general fund. The thing I really would like you to take away from this slide is that yellow bar. You're going to see that yellow bar on many other slides in here. And those are designated general funds that we collect. So those are things that we generate the revenue to pay for our operations. That's things like license receipts, regulatory cost charges, areas where we collect money.
Okay. And very briefly, if you will, very, very briefly, the reason the UGF is down is what?
Yes, thank you. Through the chair, there are 2 major decreases in 2027. There are a few other smaller items mixed in there, but the largest ones are a $5 million appropriation for Alaska Seafood Marketing Institute that was made last year as a multi-year appropriation. So technically, through the process, we then back that out in 26 or 27 because we don't need to ask for it again. It's already in the base there. There's also $1 million that was in as a one-time item for a Volunteers of America grant in the Division of Community and Regional Affairs. And we do have a listing of our grants later in the presentation.
Okay. Slide 5.
On slide 5, just very briefly, this probably looks familiar. It's from the Office of Management and Budget's presentation that you guys heard earlier this year. And really just what I want to say here is put it in context for the rest of the presentation that as we talk about general funds, we are the smallest consumer. I guess agriculture is right after us, but in the state of general funds. So we collect a fair amount, but we consume very little. Also, we had a lot of divisions that we just talked about. There's 15 different divisions in our department. We also have 33 distinct funding sources. So when I talked about there's a lot of different sources in that big yellow chunk, that's where most of them are. That includes things like investment earnings on our loan funds, things like that. There's a lot of different ones to track in our agency despite our very small size.
Okay. Unique department. Slide 7.
Absolutely. Thank you, Mr. Chair. On slide 7, again, small department, many funding sources. This slide just looks at our core divisions and gives a snapshot of the portfolio. So this is not talking about what you see in our budget. This is talking about what's already out there in the world from previous budgets, from previous fund capitalizations, from grants that have been issued. Our very small team is managing a total portfolio of grants and loans of $1.9 billion that's out there impacting Alaska's economy. So again, a lot of work in a very small agency.
Slide 8.
And in that very small agency, I'm very proud to say that we put $133 million into the general fund in last year, in fiscal year 2025. We've listed out the different sources of that revenue on this slide. They are varied across the department, but in many cases, we collect money, we spend a little bit for our operations, and then the balance goes to the general fund.
Okay. Slide 9.
On to slide 9, as you said, Mr. Chairman, I will be brief. I did want to give a snapshot of the changes in our components from 26 into 27. I've highlighted some of the more significant changes to the budget on a later slide. But as you can see, it's pretty status quo. When you see a little change between the columns, that's generally salary and health adjustments. For most of our components, there's very few changes.
Okay. Slide 10.
And similarly, for our corporations, commissions, institutes, and offices, these are those corporate partners that we talked about before. The larger changes that you'll see on here really are in the Alaska Energy Authority, where we created a new component. So you see some authority move from one component to the other as we separated out that Rail Belt Transmission Organization, where we adjusted the power cost equalization estimate, and then in the Alaska Seafood Marketing Institute, as I mentioned, where that prior year multi-year appropriation that technically has to get backed out is removed from 27.
Slide 11.
Thank you. So again, given the large number of divisions, I didn't include every single change in the presentation. Those are all absolutely included in the packet, and I'm airing your budget books, and I'm happy to talk through any of them. But there are kind of four that I wanted to highlight as we talked through. So in the Division of Community and Regional Affairs, we're continuing disaster recovery efforts. So we received multiple federal awards for disaster recovery activity in the state. We collect that federal money in the capital structure, and then we spend it in the operating structure. So we're adding just a little bit of receipts and two full-time positions, plus one vacancy that we're transferring in to support this work, and recognizing that as we receive that very significant amount of federal funding, we're talking $30 million a pop generally in those awards, that we have the appropriate staff to manage them. In the Division of Corporations, Business and Professional Licensing, and we do have slides on this later, but we are proposing to stabilize licensing fees by removing investigations costs or a significant portion of the investigations costs from the calculation for fee assessments there. So it's a net zero fund change. We're proposing to substitute receipt-supported services, which are collected from professional licensees, with business license and corporations receipts, so things collected from a broader group of Alaskans who are paying in through purchasing business licenses or updating corporations registrations. In the Alaska Energy Authority, as I mentioned, we're establishing the Rail Belt Transmission Organization. That's related to a prior year fiscal note, HB 307, I believe SLA 24. And so we're transferring some authority over from one component to the other. And then we're also adding funding as a one-time item. When we did the fiscal note, we thought that we would be collecting tariff revenue by 27. That process has taken longer than we originally estimated. And so we do need another funding source for 27, but we do expect that tariff revenue to be incoming in 28. And then in the Alaska Gasline Development Corporation, we are continuing, again, status quo budget, but it is because of how it was appropriated last year as a one-time item. We had to back it out and then add it back in, so it is in, again, as a one-time item to continue the Gasline Development Corporation. It's the same level as 26.
Let's pause here on box number two on slide 11, Corporations Business Professional Licensing. The plan in your FY27 offering is to essentially not require fully, as I understand it, the licensed folks to pay for all the costs of investigation. And instead, you're going to use funds from, as it says here, business license corporation filing fees. Where did those funds used to go?
Or yes.
Where would they typically go?
Absolutely, Mr. Chairman. Funds that we collect in excess of operations for business license and corporations activities go to the general fund currently. So it is spending revenue that would otherwise go to the general fund. I would note, and we do have this later in the presentation, that we continue to see the volume of those licensees increase. And so our revenue from those programs is also increasing over time.
Okay. So I'm actually... When I was a freshman here, I thought it was absurd that the licensee had to pay for the bad acts of other licensees. I thought that didn't make any sense. But that's the policy, and this sort of abrogates that. That's a strong word, but it's not the typical policy. Is that fair?
Yes, to the chair. I think your assessment as a freshman is the same as we share, and we've been working as a department with the legislature and with the governor's office for many years to try to figure out different ways we could approach this. I know we've talked about it over many different legislative sessions, that we recognize that it doesn't make sense for the good actors to pay for the activities of the bad actors. And sometimes those bad actors aren't even licensed, right? They're not even participating in the program, but those licensees have to pay for the investigations costs, and that is a disparity, and that most of those investigations, or many of them anyways, really serve a public protection purpose. It matters to me as an individual that my doctor is appropriately licensed and is behaving ethically all of that. It's not actually another doctor in the community's responsibility to pay for that. It's my responsibility as a citizen. So that is why we're trying to spread that across a larger pool of licensees, right? There are a lot of businesses. There are a lot of corporation registrations, and many of those overlap. So you may see a professional licensee who also has a corporation's registration for their office, who also has a business license to actually conduct business in the state. And so professional licensees still are going to be paying into this. They already are paying us money for this activity, but recognizing that it serves a broader public benefit.
How did we jump from $0 to $4.2 million? Why wasn't there a stage gate of $1.2 million?
Through the chair, Representative, $4.2 million represents the bulk of the investigations costs. Of course, those vary a little bit every year depending on what activity is going on, whether there's different witnesses that have to come in for activities. It represents the bulk of it. I think I agree with you. Any change here is a positive one, but we wanted to go with addressing the whole issue if we can.
Questions? Representative Hannon, then Stapp.
Thank you. My first question through the chair is, no statutory change needs to be executed for that change to happen?
Ms. Locker.
Yes, through the chair, Representative Hannon, no, we don't believe so. There is a section of statute that I know has been in conversation that says that the cost of that the fees must be set to approximately equal the cost of regulation. As the division has received general funds in the past for a variety of other purposes, how we have treated that is that if they're paid for by another source, they're not part of the regulatory costs that need to go into the fee calculation. So, no, we don't believe so.
Okay.
Follow-up.
So one of the conversations that's sort of been ongoing over multiple years is as we join multi-state compacts for a variety of licensures, that the concern was there's going to be a bigger cost to those who stay licensed in our state and more in their fees will go up because there'll be fewer of them in the pool that are paying into those fees. Will this change help abrogate that? So the same the investigations of bad actors or all licensees will be mitigated even if we have smaller number of social workers being licensed because we've shifted this to business license. And even if you are multi-state licensed, and I'm just choosing social workers because it was one of our recent ones that didn't seem controversial, of social workers, they'll all still need a business license. Well, maybe actually social workers don't have business licenses. So maybe it's a bad example, but you get where I'm going with that. So from the department's perspective, we think this will cover as we grow the number of multi-state licensure compacts we have and therefore potentially fewer people paying in to our professional licensing.
ASD Logger.
Yes. Through the chair, Representative Hannon, I think that you're correct. There are a lot of benefits to doing this. I think we absolutely see variation in our number of licensees in programs, and compacting may impact the number of licensees that are Alaska-based versus other places. But I think that also leads to what we're really concerned with is that some of these professions are pretty unaffordable. Some of them, the initial cost of licensure for someone who has just graduated in their profession is exceptionally high, especially in professions where we don't have very many licensees. We have 11 professions with less than 100 licensees in them, right? So one investigation can really spike those investigative costs. And so absolutely, we're recognizing that as the licensing population changes year to year and people move into the state, out of the state, hopefully compacting helps us have more of all of the professions. But absolutely, it may have a financial impact. And so we're really trying to stabilize those fees by just removing, if they have that one-year spike of an investigation, it's not part of the calculation.
Representative Stapp.
Yeah, thank you, Co-Chair. For starters, I like the fact that our word today, of the day is abrogation, and I think that's really cool that we've used it multiple times in the committee hearing through the chair. But I have a question. I am a hard time. The math is hard for me to math right now. We have zero fund changes of $4.2 million. I know that business license numbers are going down. Corporate license numbers are going up. So how is that impacting our filing fees? Because I want to say, and I think you got it on a later slide, I want to say like the business license is going down. I mean, it's increased over time, but the last couple of years has gone down, pretty substantially, and corporate is just going up marginally. So is there a fee structure difference, or what's going on through the chair?
Director Logger.
Yeah, thank you. Through the chair, Representative Stapp, you're referring to slide 18. I'm happy to jump forward to that and come back just so we can see it on the screen. It does appear on this slide that business licensing is going down, but that's really because we suspended fees in response to the COVID-19 pandemic, and we saw a large number of new registrations during that time period, and that has pretty much leveled off. I think if you actually draw a straight line from pre-pandemic to now, we are seeing a steady increase, but we do see that kind of little bubble from those free licensers.
That makes sense for the first part of the question to the chair, but as far as the revenue number, though, how would it be net? Is it because we just haven't been collecting fees through the chair?
Director Logan.
Thank you. Through the chair, Representative Stapp, it's net zero in our budget in that it is a minus to one funding source and a plus to another funding source.
Okay. I see what you did there. Thank you.
Okay. Slide 12.
Excellent. Thank you. On to slide 12. We just wanted to present our vacancy rates. I know we've been talking about, just the money in our budget, but the people in our budget is also a really important thing. I think we are continuing to see generally a steady rate. We're just about over 21% right now. I think that reflects a combination of factors. We are absolutely trying to be very conscious of where we prioritize hires in the agency, recognizing that when we don't spend money in professions, it does go to the general fund, right? Things like that, or in certain programs. We're also making sure that we're staffed for peak times, but trying to take some time as positions become vacant to really reevaluate whether they're still serving the best purpose in our agency, whether there's something else we should be doing with them. I know we just had an agency that had a regulations specialist that became vacant that they said, well, we're actually doing less regulatory work, and so we really need that support on the licensing side of the house. And so they're working on reclassifying that position to support licensees instead of regulatory work, right? So we're trying to do that work, but recognizing that as we do that, it does increase our vacancy factor slightly. I would also note that we've done roughly 160 recruitments-ish in the last year or so, which for an agency of 600 is about 27%. So I also just want to highlight, it looks like there's a steady bar of vacant positions at the top, but really what we're talking about is kind of normal, consistent turnover that we would expect in a program as people move around between roles. And so it's not the same position each month on there. It's different positions generally each month.
Okay, let's go to slide 14.
Excellent. On to slide 14. So here we've highlighted 2026 position deletions and restorations. As the committee is aware, last year 7 positions were deleted through the amendment process. Those deleted positions really did support some critical functions in the agency, one of which was filled at the time of deletion. It just was a timing difference with the report date there. So we did recreate 4 positions in the current fiscal year that relate to statutory needs or critical needs. We used existing authority for all of those recreations. So again, we're reprioritizing work to make sure that we're meeting our statutory responsibilities. So the first one we restored is in the commissioner's office. That's the associate director that serves the International Trade Office. That one was vacant for quite some time as we tried to find the right person. It's a very specialized job that you need a specialized set of skills for. We were able to hire for that position in the very beginning of fiscal year 2026. Very excited to have that incumbent in there. We did also restore our actuary position in the Division of Insurance. This is authorized by statute for insurance to have an actuary, and really what we're running into here is it's very expensive to contract for actuarial services. Having a position that we're recruiting for doesn't cost us anything while we're recruiting for it, but once we fill it, it's able to offset some of those very expensive contractual costs. So we really feel that that's, in the long term, a state savings if we can manage to get that position filled and find an actuary for the state. We did delete a position in the Alaska Oil and Gas Conservation Commission. We restored one, the Utility Engineering Analyst, in the Regulatory Commission of Alaska. That one was filled. That was the reporting date difference. And then we did restore the Utility Master Analyst in the Regulatory Commission of Alaska. Again, that's a statutorily authorized position, and that also relates to a cost savings item for RCA. Where if they have a utility case up and they need that specialized expertise, they have to contract for it as well, and that is very expensive versus having the position if they can fill it, saves them that contractual cost. And so I believe they're in active recruitment and we're interviewing last week.
Yeah, I can think of some new need there in that area. Rep Stapp for either the commissioner or director.
Thank you, Co-Chair Justin, the chairman's Kubitz. Is there any way...
Longer.
Oh, sorry.
Yeah.
Lauder. My bad. Is there any way that, so we run into this quite often where there's a vacancy position the department's actually contracting. I think that's what we're doing currently with the actuary position that's on contract. Is there any way that we can get some sort of list maybe of all the incidences in that department that is happening? Like we're contracting out services so we can have like a good understanding of kind of how the flow of the money is through the chair.
Director Lager.
Through the chair, Representative Stapp, I think we contract for a variety of needs, and I think it would be very challenging to isolate where we could meet those with an employee. I think there are a lot of cases where we could meet them for an employee with an employee, but similar to the conversation you were having previously, how long do you have that employee for if you're going to contract for it? Does it make more sense to put those resources into contracting if it's a short-term need versus a long-term need?
Follow-up, Mr. Gertrude.
Follow-up. Rep. Stapp for Director Lager.
Through the chair, Director Lager. So I understand, like, I'm not asking for everything, but any incidents where you have a vacant position that you're actually going out for contract for to fill, like, that would just be kind of nice to know, like, what is actually happening there, I think, through the chair. If we could just keep it to positions that we're actually budgeting for that are vacant, that are actually on contract through the chair.
Director.
Yeah, through the chair, Representative Stapp, I would say these are the two that I'm aware of right now. There have been different cases in the past where we, I know a few years ago we struggled to fill a nurse consultant position, and so we got some contractual support while we tried to identify that. But these are the two I'm aware of at this point.
Okay, thank you.
Slide 15.
Thank you. On slide 15, we highlighted our two FY 2026 marketing appropriations. The first one we received was for the Alaska Seafood Marketing Institute, which is one of our corporations in the department. So we've included the statutory reference there. As I mentioned, that was a $5 million multi-year appropriation that was good for 25, 26, and 27. So again, technically in the 27 budget, that gets reversed out. That's why it looks like there's a reduction, but that appropriation still does exist because it's from a prior year. And the bulk of activity for that marketing appropriation is going to occur in fiscal year 2026. And you guys heard a great presentation from Executive Director Woodrow earlier this month where he really did a great job of talking about the planning that they're doing. The second item that we had in 2026 related to marketing was for the Alaska Travel Industry Association. That was a $2.5 million capital appropriation in fiscal year 2026, and that goes out as a grant to named recipient because they're not one of our corporate agencies.
And currently there's no money that you know of in the budget for ATIA, for FY 27?
To the chair, yes.
Okay. All right. I think what we're going to do is we're going to go at ease for about 20 seconds. I'm going to give the gavel to my co-chair. We'll be at ease at 3:15.
And back on the record at 3:15. Director Lager, please continue. Excuse me.
Thank you. On slide 16, I'm not going to go through every item on here, but I did just want to provide the definitions for some abbreviations that we'll see on the next page. So we do have a number of different grants that exist in our Division of Community and Regional Affairs primarily that are in the operating budget that can sometimes be a little bit challenging to track and that are appropriated using some pretty technical transaction types that are just important to know as we look at what's in our 26 budget and then what's in our 27 budget and why.
Slide 17.
So this details those grants that were appropriated in 2026 and those were appropriated in 2027 in our proposal. I've included the transaction type as the second column as well as whether they were in language in the first column. And so really some of those transaction types, if it's a one-time item, if it's a language item, if it's a temporary item, all of those technically have to be reversed out in the following year. So when we prepared the 2027 budget, we took 2026, we removed those technical items that had to go, that technically had to be reversed. And then the ones that are restored are either ones that are in our base budget, which are noted in the second column where they're included in the base. So there's no transaction associated with them, they're just in the grants total. Or were they related to either a statutory requirement for the department or for the fund? So those are the two categories, or their life, health, safety. And so that's kind of why they're included in our base, right? Kuskokwim Ice Road, critical transportation, legal services, and you guys had robust debate on that yesterday. That's historically been in our base budget as well as one of those temporary items that gets backed out as a one-time item and restored as an income because there's a statutory calculation associated with it.
All right, I believe that brings us to slide 18.
Great. Slide 18, which we briefly looked at earlier, does show our portfolio of licenses in corporations, business, and professional licensing. So as I mentioned, we do have that little bit of a bubble following the COVID-19 pandemic as people renewed those licenses, and you can renew those licenses for 2 years, and so that's why it looks like it went a little bit longer there. As we talked about, money collected and not spent from business licensing and corporations, so those green and blue bars, does go to the general fund. But I would just note that as we see those increase, that does reflect increased revenue. So business licenses are $50. Corporations, registrations, and renewals vary anywhere from roughly $40 to roughly $200, depending on the type and the variety of corporation. So as we've seen an increase in licensees, we've seen an increase in revenue. So just to go from the start of the chart to the end, in 2015, after paying for our operations, we put $7.2 million into the general fund from business license and corporations activities. And in 2025, we put $11.08 million into the general fund. So again, that's money that we collected, that we generated, we put into the general fund. So we have seen revenue growth. So even as we talk about that, yes, our proposal is to spend money that would have otherwise gone to the general fund, this program is generating new revenue in each year.
Mm-hmm. Slide 19.
Thank you. So slide 19, as we discussed, most investigative costs are proposed to be funded from business license and corporations receipts starting in fiscal year 2027. I've included the blue bar at the bottom here to show where we've done this before for different reasons. So during the pandemic and as we were coming out of it, we recognized that we had a number of programs in deficit that would have required fee increases to those professions. And in an effort to reduce the financial burden on licensees, general funds were appropriated in 21, 22, and 23 to offset those deficits and reset them to zero. So when that happened, we didn't include those costs in the fee calculation, right? We did reset them to zero. So that's kind of the precedent for how we're structuring our requests. Similarly, we received program receipts, general fund program receipts for the Big Game Commercial Services Director in 2024. And in a fiscal note for the profession of pharmacy investigative costs beginning in 2024 as well. So we are already doing this for a portion of costs in the pharmacy board. And as we mentioned, in 2027, our proposal is to replace $4.2 million in investigative costs.
Okay. Slide 20.
Okay. Thank you for letting me talk through all of those things. I just wanted to end on two kind of high notes, some of my favorite things to talk about in the agency, despite my tiny cheesy graphic. But the Alaska Seafood Marketing Institute, I know Director Woodrow came and talked to you, but he didn't mention my favorite statistic for them, which is that Alaska seafood is still the number one protein on restaurant menus throughout the state or throughout the nation. And that is a really exciting thing, that we're more recognizable than Angus beef. People seek us out. Very exciting thing. Number one seafood. The other thing I just want to highlight here is, you know, we talked about how we are challenged by vacancy in some components, especially in our rural offices. That's where we see a lot of them. But the Division of Community and Regional Affairs, part of their work is to work with those communities and help them with things like, how does QuickBooks works, right? You're a new city administrator. How do you use QuickBooks? How do you write a resolution? Is your government doing their audits? Things like that. And they measure that activity through these management sustainability indicators. And what I'm really proud of is that despite some of those staffing challenges, despite the changes in where we're able to provide direct in-person services versus remote services, in 2016, 31% of Alaska communities were not meeting all of those benchmarks. And in 2025, again, despite the challenges, we are at 15.8%. And I think that's just a huge accomplishment. It's really an excellent representation of the work that that team does and how passionately they work on behalf of Alaskans to improve our small communities. So with that, we're happy to answer any questions.
Wonderful. Thank you, Director. Any questions from committee members? Representative Bynum.
Thank you, Co-Chair Shragi, and through the chair to Commissioner Sandy. Not really a question, but I just want to say it's good to have you here today and to see you. It's always good to have you in the Capitol. And she's a constituent of mine, so I just want to say thank you for being here.
Thank you, Representative Bynum. I appreciate being here. It's an honor.
Wonderful. Representative Hannon.
Well, thank you, Chair Shragi. I assume that most of Ketchikan is happy to not be there today because it's snowing, and some of those streets are hard to navigate because they don't get a lot of snow on the ground in downtown Ketchikan, but my understanding is they did today.
If I could, this is Commissioner Sandy.
Sure.
I have to say, nobody in Ketchikan likes it when I come home and say Juneau does it better, but on this particular case, I can't help it. Juneau does it better. I'm so impressed with the snow removal, both on the highways, on the streets, and on the sidewalks.
I didn't hear it then.
We're not going to let a competition arise here at the table.
We'll leave that for the gym.
That sounds most appropriate. All right. Well, with that light note, thank you, Commissioner. Thank you, Director. Appreciate you both being here today. Just to take care of some business here, that concludes our business for today. Our next House Finance Committee meeting is scheduled for tomorrow, February 27th at 1:30 p.m. At that meeting, we will hear two presentations from the Department of Family and Community Services. The first will be a presentation on their fiscal year 27 budget overview. Then the department will take a closer look at the Office of Children's Services budget and provide responses to their legislative audit, followed by invited testimony. With that, we are adjourned at 3:23 p.m.